Welcome to Dangerous Wisdom, a journey into mystery and a gateway to the mind of nature and the nature of mind. This is Dr. Nikos, your friendly neighborhood soul doctor, happy to be here with you so that together we can create a culture of wisdom, love, and beauty. Auspicious interbeing to you and yours, my friends, and Koinos Hermes. Deep bow to Sophia, as always. Today, I have a very delightful guest for you, friends, and a lovely topic and book that we're going to discuss. Let me start out with my guest's bio, and then I'll show you the book. I'm here with Leah Rampe, who is an experienced speaker, retreat leader, and writer with a focus on soul and earth connections. Very much a dangerous wisdom groove. You all are very familiar with those vibes. She is on the program staff of the Shalem Institute for Spiritual Formation, where she previously served as executive director, and is the senior spiritual program leader for the Center for Spirituality and Nature. In 2019, she founded Church of the Wild Two Rivers, which she continues to lead. Prior careers include teaching in public schools and universities, serving in leadership roles in Fortune 100 companies, providing executive coaching and leadership development through a company she founded, and nonprofit management, as well as a little bit of politics too, right, Leah?
That's true.
That's right. She has a PhD in curriculum from Indiana University. She lives with her husband in the co-housing community in Shepherdstown, West Virginia, not far from coal country where some of my familial heritage was from. Welcome to Dangerous Wisdom, Leah.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. So here's the book. I hope everybody can see that. That's Earth and Soul. It might be coming up mirror image for some of you. And Earth and Soul Reconnecting Amid Climate Chaos. Now, Leah, there was a little bit of resonance that I felt right at the beginning because, like you, when I heard that Al Gore was saying, hey, I'm going to have a bunch of people deliver this presentation, my first thought was, I think I'm going to do that. Now, the difference is that I thought to myself, nah, I mean, I'm this weird sort of, I'm this kind of strange philosopher who just thinks, let me just see if I could do it better or differently. I'm not sure if I want to do it like that. And so then I thought, well, in any way, I've already got a captive audience in the university, and I will bring climate to the students. But you went and got that training.
That's right.
Started going out there thinking, like, I think it's very reasonable to say, hey, if people just understand, there will be a shift. But you didn't really experience it that way. Maybe I don't know. Yeah. Should we start there?
Sure. It's probably explains a little bit about how I got to writing this book in the first place. You know, when you list the various careers I've had, they don't necessarily lead to where I am now in a real straight line. That may be true for many of us, but how we can't predict where we're going to end up is probably not unusual for a lot of us. But I was really intrigued with the Al Gore presentation and his training. And of course, when you say you went to get trained by Al Gore, it sounds very intimate, like you're sitting there in a small room with him, as opposed to that you're sitting there with 1,000 other people. And he's been doing this for years, so there are thousands of people who have been trained to deliver his slideshow. And he is very insistent on updating that all the time. So it is, you know, always kept current. But so were my daughter and I. So as we started doing this, these presentations, and I think it helped that she was a teenager at the time. And so I think there was probably some attraction to a mother-daughter team that got us maybe a few more invitations than they might have had I been doing it just by myself. We found that every single time we were going out to do this presentation, everything had been exacerbated. It was more. Whatever was the last hottest month, there was now a new one. Whatever was the last highest temperature, there was now an increase. The spread of diseases because of the warming were now further. Drought, flood, Arctic extent. On and on, everything was more and more. And it also was disheartening, I guess you would say. Maybe that's the word. As you mentioned, we got there with all this hope that people just understood. If they just really knew what was going on, that they would be motivated to change. And we didn't find that was true at all. We found people were riveted by the information. They were interested. Some of them wanted to borrow the slideshow and do it themselves. And yet that groundswell of change that we had hoped to evoke was really hard to see. And would also say that people didn't quite know what to do with it. Didn't have a sense that, oh, so now I'm going to, you know, something more than I'm going to vote and change light bulbs.
Right. It's obviously it's a very daunting problem, and we are in the same place that the wisdom traditions have always seen us. We're stuck in suffering, and there's a way out, but nobody is doing it. You know, I mean, they killed Socrates rather than change the culture. And here we are, we're barely telling the kinds of hard soul truths. You know, if you're presenting information like that, it shouldn't be that. It's threatening, but it's still this deep thing. And so some of that frustration, and which so many people there, I know there are a lot of people who are listening, and there is this, all the stuff that we go through of feeling alone, feeling that it's overwhelming, feeling that we're not sure what to do, and wondering how could it possibly be, because this just seems off the chart irrational, you know, that you're sawing right. The limb that you're sitting on, you're just sitting there sawing it, and people are saying, you know, that limb is going, no, I'm going to saw harder. And we've elected, we've decided democratically to saw much harder. So then you come to this book, and could you, you know, we both have PhDs, and to take the tension out of the notion, could you say what the thesis of this book is? You're just like, okay, what's the thesis? Well, okay, yeah. What is the thesis of this book?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, let me start by saying the question mm-hmm. that I am living with, both in writing the book and that I continue to live with, is how do we live fully alive, deeply connected in these times? I often call them edge times, times of great loss, when we see even more loss ahead of us. How do we live fully alive, deeply connected, with eyes wide open, bearing witness to what is, and still holding a pathway forward to the extent that we can, that's really beyond our knowing and beyond our lifetime?
Okay, so that's certainly one way to just, again, put the basic question the spiritual traditions ask us from time immemorial, right? Because there's always been
suffering. Absolutely.
We have a particular version of it, and yes, it seems very catastrophic, but that's really it. How do we stay vital, alive, be able to face it, and feel that we're capable of facing it, feel that somehow we're coming into the fullness of our being and awakening capacities we didn't even know we had in order to do what needs to be done that we didn't realize we had to do necessarily.
Exactly.
Yeah, but
exactly.
That suspension into the unknown. I like that edge, too. I mean, people, I have mentioned Joan Halifax's work before. Maybe you've seen her work on edge, what she calls edge states.
I haven't.
So that image, of course, goes all the way back to, in the Upanishads, the spiritual path is like a razor's edge. And then Somerset Maugham wrote the novel, The Razor's Edge. Bill Murray starred in it, which is, it's not a bad adaptation for those of you who don't want to read the novel, but it's one of Bill Murray's best films because it's a spiritual comedy. The guy you're used to doing this kind of, you know, sarcastic comedy, it's a spiritual comedy. And I think people were shocked that he wanted to do it, but he really wanted to do that movie because he understood that it was a spiritual comedy. But anyway, so The Razor's Edge, Joan Halifax has worked with this idea that, for instance, compassion is an edge state, because compassion is right at that place where if I fall on one side of that edge, I'm self-centered again. If I go to the other side, it's pathological altruism, pathological stingyism, pathological altruism. And on the razor's edge is it's real functional compassion. And how do we stay at that place? So I love all that you're asking. Okay, yeah, that's the deep question. And framed by you're seeing the world in crisis and wondering, wait a second, why are people, I'm trying to explain this, and they probably know even more than they realize, and we're still not doing it.
Well, I'm going to draw a little bit of a dotted line between the Al Gore trying to do the slideshow and sort of where I came to before I wrote the book, which was the concern for the illusion of separation. And so I had moved into leading retreats and pilgrimages that were centered around deeper and deeper connections to Earth, because I became convinced, I am convinced, that at the heart of so much of our lack of capacity to make the kind of changes we need is the being stuck in the old stories, the stories that tell us humans are separate from, that we are not connected to, that there is no intelligence to be gained from this living world around us. And I want to flip all of that in my own life and in the teaching and the writing I do. I want to flip all of that on its head, because I think as long as we are looking at the issue of climate change as a problem to be solved, and we miss that deep and loving and rich and long time cosmic universal connections to the living world around us, we don't have either the commitment to or the wisdom, the collective communal wisdom, to make the kinds of changes that are really invited.
Yeah. There are deep, deep resonance in our work, and I think maybe we'll get to that. But that's one of the big problems, and I would really love to convey what I think you're trying to touch on as well. I really try to, when people feel like I'm overwhelmed, I don't know what to do, it's because we are in that same style of consciousness that caused the problem, if we think I've got to solve it now, rather than saying, hey, unburden yourself. The world will solve this if you participate again. If you get back in the dance, she will dance us through it. You don't have to worry about that. You're not alone, but you have to call on the world and let it call you back to it too.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that would just be so good if we could. And of course, now that's an unknown. That's the new, well, how do I do that? Okay. But just to say, well, what if I didn't have, what if there's a whole team of beings ready who have already proven themselves over billions of years by inventing us and keeping this whole thing going all that time? Hey, puny human, you it's okay. We'll help.
Yeah. Well, you probably know, I love the work of Janine Benyus, who has done so much about the reminding us that we are surrounded by genius.
Yes.
There's so many geniuses around us. And one of my chapters that I loved writing and I love reading is just myriads of examples about how the living world has such considered wisdom. And not only models for us, I believe, but invites us into co-creation of a different way of collaborating, being, and living together in
ways
that are, well, you talk about love and beauty and wisdom. That's it.
That's it, right? Yeah, they're interwoven. Well, and what I was just going to say is that it's not merely that the world invites us into co-creation, but it is saying, look, this is the world. The world is co-creation. So either participate in the dance or it's going to get hard for you, because that's what the dance is. It's not like you have a real choice here. And indigenous people often like to say that, yeah, you can pass all the laws you want, but nature's got the law. You either follow that or you're going to have a problem. And the wisdom traditions I see as the teachings of attunement with that. That's what we're trying to do. Okay, so now, I don't know, have we come far enough to say, what is the thesis of your book?
that to live deeply connected, listening to, discerning with the living world, and to open to our soul wisdom, which, and when I put in, I've got a lot of parentheses in what I'm speaking, so I'm sorry about that. But
it's okay.
This parentheses is, it sounds like two separate journeys, and it is a single journey.
Right.
It is not separate to look at the gifts so deeply embedded within us, the reason we are called here now.
Mm-hmm.
It is an ecological reason. It is because we are part of an ecosystem. So the practices, I think, are about tuning into our own calling. At the same time, it's tuning into Earth's call, Earth's wisdom, Earth's invitation. And those are one. The more deeply we are interwoven with the living world, the more deeply we become who we truly are,
mm-hmm.
and vice versa.
Yeah.
So that is really what I'm all about, is that Earth and soul are interwoven. They are one. We belong. And we're called here.
Mm-hmm.
We're called here in ways that help lean toward life and liveliness.
There you go. Yeah. Cultivating the whole of life onward. And there's an edge state too. There's a razor's edge, not one that Joan Halifax talks about, but that you see that the place where we realize ourselves is at the razor's edge between the personal and the impersonal. It's as if we think it's a choice of one or the other. Or the way Martin Buber put it in I and You, he said, freedom and destiny, they meet, and that's where your activity is. The place where you feel like, wait a second, it was destined, but wait a second, that's the only place I found the freedom. And so this almost paradoxical embrace of, okay, well, how do I walk that razor's edge? And I find myself, when I realize that my soul and the soul of the world, in fact, the soul of the great mystery, are not two things. That's the sign-off for every episode of this. You're going to have to hear me say that again. But that's how we end every episode. Yeah. Your soul and the soul of the world are not two things. Mm-hmm. But then I say, take good care of them. They're not mm-hmm. two things. Take good care of them, to reinforce that. It's a paradox. It's a bit of a paradox.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, isn't it fun? I mean, really, because we sit here trying to put words around, either in writing or spoken words, around what we're trying to describe that's really wordless.
Yes.
And timeless.
Yes.
And you know, I'm really clear, it's also beyond my knowing. So I'm also kind of reaching out and trying to touch glimmers.
Yes.
And then I'm trying to explain to you what I'm trying to touch. So I do feel that the conversation, the language is important. I think it really sustains our commitment and our learning, and yet it's not about learning either. So there you go. It is.
Like,
isn't this fun? Right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, because it depends. Because like, there's a way in which we have to engage in the learning process of how we heal everything that we damaged, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that the world is going to learn how to balance itself again. Because we did things that, you know, force the world's going to have to learn what to do with the plastic. And we have to surrender to that learning. We have to say that we don't know, and that the knowing actually will never be individualized in a person, but that the world is going to come to know how to be after this. And we have to kind of come to know, but understanding that, yes, it's not me what I know in this cranium, but there's a knowing working through me. Yeah, it's really beautiful. Now, about that, let me ask you a thing. There is a bit of language that has become popular, and you've used it a little bit, even though ultimately I think you have a view that's much more like what I would say, but sometimes you do say, moving from the head to the heart.
Mm-hmm.
And don't you think that a little bit, see, what I often say about that is, because we are tempted to say, well, people heard the presentation, they intellectually understood it, but then somehow, so we have to move from our head to our heart. But then I sometimes say, yes, but in this context, there's no connotation in which the heart indicates, it has an emotional connotation, the head has a rational connotation, and then we've divided reason and emotion again. But really, your view is much more like mine, which is, if people say to me, what's the soul? I say that's our total intelligence, including the intelligence that transcends the boundaries of time, space, identity, the bag of skin. So that soul thinking would be whatever you meant by the heart and whatever you meant by the head and even what is larger. Because I feel like that's where what you would say is the thinking we need, right? Something more holistic.
Yeah. So contemplatives speak about mind and heart. That's one place to begin to say even that separation of mind and heart. That's an old framing, mind and heart. And that's really a better statement, you know, to not separate our head from our heart.
Yes.
And we do it to try to draw attention to the fact that sometimes I am feeling all about how I can think my way into a new way of being. And right. I am not attending to, even though my heart is there doing all of its inviting.
Yeah.
I'm not attending to it. It's a place where there's an invitation,
yes.
I think, to bring that all together cohesively. And yes, I see soul as, I will say I've been really influenced by a lot of reading of like Bill Plotkin and some of his work as he talks about soul and thinking about that as a way in which we are deeply connected to the soul of the world, or as you're saying, within, how we are living within the soul of the world. And it's more than and probably indescribable for me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let me go to a couple of touchstone moments. One is sort of like a synchronicity in your process, and another one, a story, which is partly that the larger wisdom of the natural world and other beings, but also a little bit just like the way the world can kind of speak to us almost directly pointing at our foolishness. Would you share the story about the dolphin?
Mm.
I do like that because I love dolphins. I love horses, and dolphins are the horses of the ocean, or horses are the dolphins of the land, depending on which one you like better. But
I love that story. It's one of my favorite. I'm so glad you picked it out. I haven't actually gone back and read it in a while, but it is the story of, imagine yourself as a young out-of-college intern, and your work is to go to work in a research location where there is a single solitary dolphin in a tank, a huge tank. And your objective is to test the visual acuity of that dolphin. And so, you know, imagine yourself as a humble intern, and your job is to stand behind a small screen with a very small cutout so that you are mostly hidden, and to press a button that creates a sound. And when the dolphin recognizes the particular sound appropriately by slapping a paddle, the dolphin gets a fish. Now, the teller of the story, J.D. White, says for sure he knows that the dolphin knows that he is behind that screen, even though that, for all intents and purposes, is not supposed to be the case by the designer of the experiment. And he didn't design it. He has no choice. So he follows the protocol to a T. Well, the dolphin goes through a period of time where he gets every single answer correct. And as he receives the fish, he takes every fish and stockpiles it at the bottom of the tank over and over and over again until a certain point when he switches and starts to get every single answer wrong. Now, it's apparent that your visual acuity is pretty clearly 100%, not 50-50 if you're getting it 100% right or 100% wrong. But what the dolphin does is when he gets it wrong and the buzzer tells him he's got it wrong, he goes to the bottom, he picks up a fish, and he cocks his rostrum back and throws the fish right dead into that center hole, smacking JD in the face over and over again.
Yeah.
It was so clear that the dolphin had taken over the game.
Mm.
And then, you know, the tragedy of this is when we think about how social dolphins are and what we know, just even the little bit we know about how they live in families and how they care for each other and how they are together. And here's this dolphin that has been all alone. He's making this grad assistant into his playmate, into his companion, into his partner, I think, in the best way he possibly knows how. So it's, to me, it's a poignant story. It's heartbreaking. It's funny because over and over again, you're getting smacked in the face, and hauntingly beautiful to me. I'm curious what drew you to it.
Oh, I just absolutely love it. I mean, it really feels like you're getting slapped in the face with a signal of your own ignorance that you're ignoring, you know, and, man, it's just a beautiful image, that dolphin saying, hey, really, get serious here, you know? And, you know, I think of how I often think about Franz de Waal's book that asks, are we intelligent enough to know how intelligent other beings are? And the answer is definitely no. Mm-hmm. And when we think about trying to communicate with alien life, and when we think about life on other places, and we don't know life here. So I often say, you know, because the astrobiologists have recognized that they have to look for life as we may not know it yet. Mm. And when I think of the phrase life that we don't yet know, it's still here. Mm-hmm. And then connected to that is the fact that we have people with a business plan that says, hey, we don't know how to live here at all together. Even though this place has spent billions of years making itself perfectly suited for us, let's go somewhere else. Let's go to Mars. And the amount of money that we're spending on that, so then that's going to bring me to the story about the Congo. Because that is also very poignant when you think how Bezos and Musk could have just written a check to solve that problem, but they don't want to do that. So will you share the story about the Congo?
Yeah, this has to do with an accord, an agreement that was reached in Scotland to help to save the forests. You know, we have such few old growth forests left. And one of those of vital importance is in the Congo. And I don't remember the number. I haven't pulled that story up either in a while, but
it's half a billion, 500 million.
Half a billion. Okay. Yeah. So I was reading about these forests, these old growth forests, and the incredible importance that they are to the world. And you, and we know, I mean, they're not just important for beauty. They are not only important for the people who live there and all of the beings of all types that live there. They're creating our earth systems, they're creating our weather and managing our wind. And this is earth in the form of a forest. So there was a hope that this money would be used to help save the forest, because of course people in the government, in the Democratic Republic of Congo in particular, were desperate for supporting their people. But that fell through. Governments did not own up to their commitments. They did not put together the funding. And so you have the minister in the Congo saying, well, then we're opening it up for oil and gas drilling in this forest. We know the tragedy of when we open up the forest to any kind of intervention. Roads come in, land is compacted, it allows invasives, as people as well as plants and animals, to enter. I mean, we know all the damage that just begins the moment there's a road going into the forest for any reason. Mm. And the minister said, but I am, you know, it is not my job to save the world.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It is not my job to save the world. Mm. And then we're struck with, oh my goodness, whose is it?
There you go.
Whose is it?
There you go.
You know, and of course, I don't really like to talk about saving the world, as if we are sort of the, you know, that cowboy image of riding to the rescue. But for sure, it's our job to collaborate with the living world around us and to do what we can to make sure that it's healthy and thriving.
And so,
if it isn't, we aren't. Yeah,
exactly. If it isn't, we are. And so, if anybody is not familiar with these attempts, these are ways to try to be more reasonable as human beings, because we're being very unreasonable. I mean, that's why I think it's still important to talk about critical thinking and reasoning, but to try to make it more and more holistic. But the idea is, the Congo is there are so many horrors, ecological, interpersonal, social, so many challenges that the people face there that are because of the way we think and the way we know ourselves, each other, and the world, especially here in the dominant culture, because the rare earth minerals and the oil and the gas, the coltan, all the things that go into your cell phone, and then these kind of fake maneuvers for the corporations. Oh, we'll be good, and we'll trace it back carefully. The really smart thing, it would be to do what some of these countries have asked. Look, just pay us and to keep the forest intact, because we're performing a service for you. As you say, it's not merely beauty, but the thing is, we could recover but beauty, because if beauty is really beauty, then it has to have wisdom and love in it. So there is a wisdom in the forest already. Mm-hmm. There is a love. There's a care of the earth, of us. And that's all they said. Just look, just give us money to leave it alone. And a mere $500 million to keep a massive forest, when we don't understand how that's a bargain, we are really far gone.
Yeah.
And then, as you point out, sure, it falls through, and yet we're paying hundreds of millions of dollars for someone to blow up rockets in Texas and to take people into the ultimate joyride. And with this plan, the business plan is, we're wrecking this one, let's go to another one where there's not even anything. And we'll just, we'll take all of our aggression and confusion, and it'll just be at a place with no trees, no birds. Well, how is that a business plan? But it's astonishing. And you were reading that just at a time when you were just happened to be reading about trees. That's why I meant the synchronicity, is that you were reading about the forest, and then boom, here's this article saying, hey, we're destroying this forest.
Exactly. I was reading the book. I was looking for the title here, Evergreen. And Thomas Lovejoy was one of the co-authors of that book, talking about those five great forests that we must save.
Yeah. Five great forests.
That's the way he's framing it.
Well, you name those. So everybody, what we're talking about is that these are massive ecologies. We think like, oh, there's a forest behind my house or something. But the idea here is that there are these five massive forests that really help hold the world together.
Sure. Well, we're certainly talking, of course, about the Amazon.
Yeah.
And we know the challenges of the Amazon, everything from trying to, let's have more land to grow beef.
Right.
Whatever. The boreal forest in Canada.
Yeah.
Much of our well-known toilet paper comes from cutting down portions of the boreal forest in Canada.
Yeah.
The taiga and across Russia, the Congo, and New Guinea, the forests of New Guinea, which, of course, are under assault because we need palm oil.
Yeah.
And I put need in quotes, but palm oil is in so many products. We have to be really vigilant if we are not going to buy, if we're not going to support the palm oil industry, because it is in everything from, makeup and lotions to so many foods.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Once you make that decision that you're not going to buy palm oil, you realize how much it's in.
Body
care, food, it's surprising. Sometimes there will be a pledge that it's done safely, but you can't always be sure. I mean, it's definitely...
That's right.
Yeah.
I think we can probably have a healthy skepticism and not be too far off around some of those promises.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking, there used to be a conversation in some of the corporations where I worked that you get a lot more credit for saving something from, where there's already imminent danger and things have gone wrong, than you do from seeing ahead of time what needs to be done and stepping in to prevent it.
Yeah.
And people were talking about that at a personal level when they were talking about it in the sphere I was in the corporate world. You know, how do you give any acknowledgement at all to somebody who saw what might happen and made changes so that it didn't? This is a bit of what I think is going on when we are looking for some other way that has nothing to do with getting to know and understand better the world around us and take steps to be living in greater connectivity and harmony, that love and wisdom and beauty, and take those steps. There's this, we'll keep plundering until we can plunder no more. And at the same time, try to find a technical solution. There's a love of technology or an attraction to technology that is somehow really misdirecting us, or we're allowing ourselves to be misdirected.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm just playing with that. It occurred to me when you said it that there's something that's attracting us about fixing.
Yes.
Rather than preventing. Do we feel better? Do we feel more superior because we've stepped in and created the rocket? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it's part of how we rationalize the process is also it is that we think that we can fix it. I mean, this is that very issue, though, is what Gregory Bateson's work tried to get at, is that the person who tells you, I have a solution to this problem, is actually the problem screaming at you, right? So that very mind that says, I have that is the problem talking already. You hear the sirens call to, I can fix it, don't worry about it, but it's actually just the problem whispering in a different voice, or because that mind, that style of thought is the issue. And it's the same style of consciousness. It is that I will follow conscious human purpose rather than trying to figure out how we participate in the thinking that nature is, because that's thinking. And sometimes when people say, oh, we're trying to think our way through, I say, no, well, that's not the problem. It's that what you're calling thinking isn't. It's, you know, you can call it schmeasoning, but it's not reasoning. You know, the nature uses actual reasoning to create a human being. That's not irrational. I mean, what are you going to call that? It's a mental process. It's just that there's no thinker. So relax. You don't have to be the thinker who solves the problem. it will.
Interesting.
Yes, but you're right, because we want. I think we're addicted to the dominant culture too. In my dissertation, I often talk about how I wrote about a woman who absolutely. She just said, "Look, I'm addicted to my Keurig coffee machine. That thing is my life." Because do you know, if she was a single mother working, you know, 60, 80 hours a week, do you know how nice it is that I can just press this button and there's the coffee? And I really felt that, like, okay, yeah. And when you're in it, it just, that feels so good that that's all I have to do. And if somebody tells me I have to give that up, or it's a bad idea, or it's bad thinking, then I'm suddenly like, but here, again, you and I are really meeting in our work. I really like how you're saying, but what if you don't realize that now is where you're having to suffer and sacrifice and give things up? Mm-hmm. That what your ego is telling you, oh no, I have to give up, I'll have less, I'll be less. I want. Actually, the earth is saying, if you let go, you'll have more. What a weird thing, right?
Exactly. And I think, you know, Rebecca Solnit occasionally talks about this idea that, like, what if it's not really giving up? You know, what if it's not like a life of depravity, you know, being deprived of so much we know and love? What if it's actually more?
Yeah.
And I think that it's true. I think it is more. I think that it's more, well, it's more of the connection. It is more of the compassion. It's more loving.
And so you probably see people go through that feeling of finding some of the abundance when you hold workshops, I would think, right? Do you find people are actually able to I mean, that's the whole point of philosophy, is to say, hey, yeah, what you thought that you were going to have to give up something, but you realize that the thing you were giving up was actually a problem that you were holding on to so hard. It was a burden you were carrying. I think as you did quote her, and the way she Solna put it is nice, that this is the austerity. You are now under austerity. Mm-hmm. And if you would only let go of all the toys they're using to keep you in it. But do you see that with people? Do you feel like, oh my gosh, yeah, there's...
Well, I think you see it with individuals, and I think this is also what you see writ large. I can't help but think about loneliness as epidemic. That's not caused by, having too much time in the living world. That's because we've lost our connections, yes, to each other, but also to who we are, held in this whole web. We've lost the cosmic story. I think one of the things that I'm so grateful for, the Brian Swim and Thomas Berry and Mary Evelyn Tucker and those people who brought the cosmic story back front and center to help us understand we're part of this long lineage. We're, as is often said, this little leaf on the family tree. So yes, I see it in the retreats, and I see it on the pilgrimages that I used to lead, where we are able to get some sense of what might be possible in that shift from placing ourselves in the center and believing that we need more to be more.
Mm-hmm.
That it even is about us.
Yeah.
So that's a real shift to take ourselves out of the center.
Yeah. And there, have you worked with the Earth Charter much?
No.
It's useful to look at. It's a very remarkable document. But there, it's a kind of unprecedented document. Massive dialogue across cultures, spiritual leaders, scientists, political leaders, all coming together to talk. It's a civil society document, and to talk about what is a framework to begin to live better together with the Earth. And the phrase that they have in there is a shift from having more to being more.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really, really the journey of language. Really, language was a big thing. Sometimes word choices were hashed over for, months, years. So it's a really beautiful thing to consider. And a lot of organizations kind of agree to live in alignment with it. So it's high schools, universities, all kinds of organizations across countries and around the world. But that phrase is in there, and it's really, I think, important.
Thanks for bringing that up. It's been a long time since I've thought about that. And it would be really rich, I think, for me to look at it with new eyes, too, because like probably all of us, I'm on this journey to try to understand what I need to let go of.
Yeah, we all are. Yeah, that's definitely. Yeah. Renunciation is going to be part of every, that Phoenix fire where the stuff that we were clinging to burns away. And then we realize that we are born out of it, that we needed it. We needed to go through that. In Buddhist philosophy, there's a practice of trying to ease yourself into it. Many practices, actually, but one that I rather think is lovely is that you go around. Maybe it depends on what your personality is, but it might, for a lot of us, it could just be right in your home, and you look at things that you really like, and you imagine giving them away.
Mm.
You don't have to do it, and you don't do something where you would create resentment. But if you just say, oh, I really love this, it's my favorite sweater. I love this sweater. I love when winter comes and I get to put it. And then you just imagine, oh, I just picture giving it away again and again and again and again. And it kind of strengthens that muscle of release, and how nice. Mm-hmm. And also just sharing the good feeling that you just, oh, I wish everybody could have such a sweater that made them so, feel warm and cared for. And okay, yeah.
That triggered for me a reminder, and I would like to now that I'm thinking about it, revive it. I walked up to a woman once. It was happened to be at a farewell party from an organization I was leaving. And I walked up to her and I said, "That is such an interesting pin. I really like your pin." And she said, "Oh, I'm glad you do. Let me give it to you." And she took it off and pinned it on me. You know, wow, how countercultural was that? And so then that's been fun. You know, it was fun to wait for somebody to come to me and say that they liked it, you know, so that I could do the same. But I'm thinking like, gosh, you know, I have a whole box of seldom used jewelry. I could practice on that.
Yeah, isn't that sweet? I like that idea too. I know people who will sometimes, they'll come across something and they'll say, "I think this is for somebody." And partly because they feel like, oh, this is really great, but I actually think this is not for me, but I'll take care of it. And then they'll meet. I've seen those meetings happen. Oh, I have something for you. And they'll like take it off their neck or whatever. I've been wearing this and this is actually, it's for you. And you think, what a beautiful moment and how meaningful to feel that you participated in a synchronicity somehow that was for somebody else.
And the fact that we're talking about it shows how rare that is.
Totally. You know? Yeah. I had one not long ago. I was sitting around a campfire and we were telling stories and we were talking about, and I was talking about, somehow I said the phrase, you know, we really need to think about giving the Black Hills back. And it turns out the fella sitting on the other side of the fire had really been involved in it and told the whole story of how they went out and they did get this big part of the Black Hills back. It was just a beautiful story. The next day, I happened to be going into a thrift store with a friend, and there's a picture of an indigenous, of Geronimo. A Gaul. And this huge picture. And I thought, get out. And so I bought it and drove it up to him, and he was just like so thrilled to see that. He just couldn't believe it. It's hanging in his barn now. To this day, wow, what do you know? It was something I had never seen anything like it, and there it was.
Some earth blessings there.
Now, tell me about the Church of the Wild Two Rivers. I really like that.
Sure. I really like it too. There is something called the Wild Church Network, and it is a very loose organization of other wild churches that support each other. So you can belong to it or not. And belonging just means, hey, you know, we're kindred spirits here. And we'll have a little map where we show kindred spirits. People do it very differently. I started this 6 years ago when I moved to the Shepherdstown area. I thought I was going to help somebody else who I had understood was going to be starting it. And I went to have coffee with her and she said, "Oh no, I'm not doing that." So I went around saying, "Well, if I'm supposed to, you know, help somebody, let me know who it is." And no one ever showed up. And I finally decided, oh, that must be me. So our intention is to engage some of these practices together and support each other in these practices of wandering the land, sitting with trees, watching water, listening deeply, receiving wisdom of earth. We start out, we meet once a month and we always meet outdoors, and we start out with a little theme and a bit of a conversation and introductions to each other, because we are always creating community in real time. It's never the same group of people there. So we're creating community of like-hearted people in a community of within a community of beings. And after we talk for a little bit, there's 40 minutes where people may take a question, or they are invited to take a practice and wander or sit. And then come back into the large circle and we share a little bit in small groups. And then we share in a large group, 5 words or less in our large group. And we might do a chant, we might have a circle dance, people bring their own poems or songs or music that they want to share. And we always close with a gratitude circle and acknowledge all of the beings around us and each other for being there. And so it's a 2-hour block of time, and that's it. And we go our ways, and many people come back again the next month to do the same thing.
Yeah, there's been a lot of discussion about the loss of third space. It's a technical academic term, but the idea is you've got home life, you've got work life. Once upon a time, the union hall was a third space, or certain bars, coffee shops, bowling teams, but that we don't really have them and we don't stay in them and talk with each other enough in the third space. I often talk about how the dictatorships, because tango teachers would always talk about this when I would study with them, take workshops, and they would talk about how the dictatorship was perfectly happy to import all the rock and roll that was causing a moral crisis in America in its early days. You know, this is the end of Elvis gyrating and singing these songs. It's the end of America. The dictatorship was happy in Argentina to import all that. What they didn't want was tango because it was such an intimate third space where people are hugging each other for hours on end, mostly staying sober because dancers don't want to lose their capacity to dance. That's dangerous. Sober people who are hugging each other and listening to songs about real human connection and loss and love. And so you're really establishing that, because if we're going to practice better relationality, we got to start. Mm-hmm. And it's wonderful that you're offering that. And how many people tend to show up? You're in a small area, so I can't imagine it's super big.
Well, no, it's not super big. You know, there may be occasions where there's only 15 or so, but, you know, 25 or
That's
so
nice.
Is maybe about how many we would usually have. I think a couple times we've had 40. It's like, you know, in between.
I like that.
And I never exactly know how many are coming, even though I, you know, encourage people to sign up in case I need to tell them that, I don't know, if the bridge is washed out and you can't get there or whatever. But, you know, the people, the open space technology, as they call it, open space, it's the same kind of rules. Whoever is there is who's supposed to be there. You know, whenever you arrive, it's when you were supposed to arrive. When it's time to go, it's time to go. And whatever we talk about will be what we were supposed to talk about. So,
I like that. And you're in the, so I take it, is that sort of, what's the ecology like there? Is that sort of Blue Ridge Mountain still?
We are at the end of the Blue Ridge. Yeah, we're not very far from Harper's Ferry.
Okay.
So we're where the Shenandoah meets the Potomac. And the Blue Ridge come kind of tailing out there. So it's a hilly area, karst topography, so lots of caverns. But it is that kind of from Virginia on up Blue Ridge, Shenandoah Valley.
Yeah, I lived in Charlottesville for a little while, and so not super far away. And then also just on the sort of southwestern Pennsylvania, I spent time too. So I'm familiar with different aspects of kind of the same larger bioregion.
Southwestern Pennsylvania would be very, I mean, we're a hop, skip, and a jump. We're Virginia and Maryland meet, and Pennsylvania is just right there. And
Across the
water from Antietam is where Shepherdstown is.
There's a did you ever is it what's it which book is it in? Did you ever read any Chris Hedges work?
Yes.
Okay. Did you see the one he did, the graphic book that Days of Destruction? I think Days of Revolt.
No.
There's a beautiful chapter in there about a man from West Virginia, from coal country. It's really talk about somebody connected and knowing the world. It's beautiful. It's really a beautiful description. I read a passage of it in one of the episodes on The Way of the Wolf. So if anybody wants to just hear from that passage, you can listen to that series, which is a great series on touching on a lot of what we're touching on. But this guy's name was Larry Gibb, and he said, you know, his dad worked in the mines, and this would have been quite a long time ago, because Larry probably by this point, he must be in his 60s or 70s or something. I mean, he was not young when Chris Hedges interviewed him, but his dad got hurt in the mines, and they ended up having to go to Michigan because he thought what happens to a lot of miners, they'll try to go to Detroit, you know, to get job in the automobile industry. If something happens to a mine, mm-hmm. or if something happens to them, they can't mine, but they can still do some labor. And so he said, I was amazed. I didn't know I was poor till we went to Michigan and people told me that I was. And he said, but what is amazing is how in the world, with everything I had in West Virginia, and he describes he had this hawk that would just like fly around with him, and the three-legged fox that would hang out with him, and all these animals and all this food that he could just eat, the pawpaws and the berries. And he said, yeah, I was the richest kid in the world. And I had so many friends, non-human friends. I don't even think he mentions a human friend. He's just like, I've got a bobcat and a fox. And it's just like, wow, the richness of this guy's life. And to hear somebody who's just like a coal miner, the way he talks about the mountain being alive, it's really, it shows you that, you know, it's available. It's there. We can sink back into it. And it's worth looking at that, even that one chapter. It's a nice thing that he did in collaboration with Joe Sacco, who did the graphic art in it. It's really nice.
Yeah, thank you for that. Mm. Yeah, and some of us don't have to go very far back in our families to know a time when that kind of connection was there.
Yeah,
you know that it's not always as distant as we think it is.
Yeah, and we have to carry something in, because I also remind people. Here on Turtle Island, if you just being in the woods would be enough, then the world wouldn't look like it does, because we came here and this place was so incredible that nobody in Europe believed it. They just thought, okay, you're making it up. It can't be. And now it's not. So those people were living in it. And they also didn't quite know. So that's like, it's there, and yet there's some kind of deep work that we're going to, that learning that we were talking about, we will have to relearn. We will have to re-indigenize. And yeah, even if we thought our grandfather, who was a farmer, was so connected to the land, there was a whole lot he didn't know. Mm-hmm. Right? Anyway, yes, but it's there. At least it's there. And there's a richness. If nothing else, it's just that this man felt so rich as a boy and still has so much love for that mountain. Yeah.
Lovely story.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. What else would you like to reflect on? If we've come a ways, as usual, the philosopher tries to bring up some things that maybe people haven't heard before when they've talked about their wonderful books. And I want to say it again for anybody. This is Earth and Soul. And is there anything else about the book, about your journey, about the work you're doing now that you'd like us to know about?
Well, I will mention that I have written another book, co-authored with a colleague, Beth Norcross, who founded the Center for Spirituality and Nature. And the Discovering the Spiritual Wisdom of Trees is coming out on April 22nd.
Discovering the Spiritual Wisdom of Trees. I like that.
So it's been my real honor and pleasure to work on this with Beth. We started a class on the Spiritual Wisdom of Trees about 4 years ago. And she has training training as an arborist that I don't have, as a forester. So we had a really interesting and rich collaboration, but it's been a really exciting and fulfilling opportunity to do so many classes on the spiritual wisdom of trees. Because people are so drawn to trees, and trees seem to be like such a an entree for people into seeing the soul connections. We start by talking about trees as soul friends in the Anamkara Celtic tradition of having a soul friend that you could share with, and that soul friend could share with you as well. What is well with your soul, you know? So that's something we're looking forward to. And I would also say I have just loved, the reason I wrote Earth and Soul is because I really wanted that opportunity to help generate, even to be in conversations with people about this topic. So I really appreciate when I get invitations like this. I love being invited to book groups where people are reading and wanting to talk about it. So I'm available for that. It's, occasionally somebody says, how many books have you sold? And I'm like, I honestly don't know. And it's really not my question.
Yeah.
You know, my question is, are we having conversations that help bring us together and heal some of the wounds for human and more than human world and point us toward ways of living that might bring vibrancy and mutual thriving into our consciousness and into our intention and into this world, as we've said before, even if it's well beyond our time.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Well, maybe I can have you and Beth back on the podcast. We can just, so it's been released or?
In April.
In April. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so available for pre-order if you want to order 4 months ahead of time.
Well, you know what's happened sometimes is that ahead of an interview, a publisher or a publicist will send me a preprint copy. So that's an option, but we can also wait until after it comes out.
No, we can make that happen.
Yeah, well, I know it happens all the time.
We can make that happen. Yeah,
that's many an interview I've gotten the book as a preprint. Okay, so. Yeah, that's really good stuff. And now it is a really good time, especially as we need to really get wise in relation to trees and understand their participation mm-hmm. in forests and understand all the all the spiritual and symbolic significance. And speaking of symbols, I always love, maybe we can finish with this because I know people have been responsive to this, and I've always loved the symbol of the Möbius strip. And in the philosophical community, I have deep, deep respect for Thich Nhat Hanh, who made a kind of career out of saying "no mud, no lotus."
Yeah.
To see the interwovenness of we just want the lotus, but you don't get it without the mud. And you had a kind of symbolic exercise, and you know these are the kinds of things that we have to be careful with, but it's nice because it does convey something to the soul, that symbol that the soul needs. Would you like to share your delightful Möbius strip exercise?
I would. And you know what just popped in my mind? So this is a synchronicity here that we really hadn't brought to the fore, grief. And that is something that I write about.
Yeah.
Because I am inviting us to consider both a responsibility and an opportunity of bearing witness to loss, of being with places that have been devastated by our interventions or causes that beyond what we really understand, and to just be with that as we would be with a friend, a family member, whatever, in their dying or in their lost. And I recognize that it can be hard to open your heart to that, to allow your heart to break, really. So I'm suggesting that people just take that long strip of paper, and on one side write those things that are bringing grief, or maybe something that they feel that they're holding and bringing them sorrow and loss. And then to flip that over and write about their remembrances of awe and wonder and beauty. And then as they take that strip to make that final twist to put it together so that there is no one side or the other, that Möbius strip shows us that's all life, you know, it's all interwoven together. To know, as Joanna Macy says, that when our hearts are broken open, they can hold more. They hold more love. They hold more beauty. Even as they hold the pain, we're reminded of what we really treasure and love. And so to allow all of that to be one is going to be important on this journey.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as we live, we are going to experience loss and grief. As long as we love the living world, as long as we are part of it, which of course we can't help but be, then it's there. It will be there. So holding that is a practice.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Leonard Cohen, there is a crack exactly. in everything. That's how the light gets in. And so for those of you, if you're not, you can, everybody here can Google Mobius strip, but it is the idea that what appears to be two sides isn't. What appears to be two is really ultimately one from a perspective. And the way it works is to, you can imagine like a ribbon of paper. So maybe something that's much longer than it is wide. And that if you took the two ends and stuck them together, you would have a circle. But if before you stuck the two ends together, so if you had a circle, if you stuck them together, then there'd be an inside of the circle and an outside of the circle, a top and a bottom to that side of to that strip of paper. But if you give it a twist and then stick it together, as you trace your finger along, you never lose contact. So that means there couldn't be really a one side or the other, because you've just traced it around and around and around and around it goes. And it's just recognizing that non-duality, that we're not alive and then dead. It's living, dying all the time. Living, dying all the time.
And trees are such a good example of that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, releasing those leaves that fall to the ground, that eventually compost, that feed the trees, I mean, there's a multitude of ways we could talk about trees and death and dying. A few of them I do try to talk about in the book.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah, there's a feedback loop, the Mobius feedback loop is the spiritual feedback loop Sophia uses. Okay, wow, that is wonderful. So thank you for sharing that. And I encourage people to try that. And yes, and for those of you who want some extra support, as you regular listeners know, I always say compassion study is the place to begin, because it allows us to find our capacity to turn toward the pain so it can heal. And so we have resources on the meditation page at dangerouswisdom.org. Just go to the resources page, click on meditations. If you start practices of compassion and Tonglen, this can give you the strength to turn toward that grief, because the pain is asking for our attention. And you were talking about how do we tend? How do we attend? Tend to the fire of the world. And that, but we do have to face it, because we don't, that too is just really uncomfortable. And I think that's part of why we have the rationalizations about tech, is that it feels so nice if someone tells us they'll fix it, rather than looking at how much pain we already feel, how odd we already feel. And wow, it's really. And there too, isn't it interesting? There's a way in which America did vote on emotion. People did vote with their heart, but their heart is anxious, afraid, angry. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we were thinking clearly enough. But goodness, if we could just admit that we're hurting and be together with it and talk about it, not so that we wallow in it, but just even because if you have the grief and you just sit and talk about your time with a tree, that was something. You know, it's not like you have to talk about the thing all the time. And that's sometimes, too, where we get trapped. If we just worry over and over about the climate anxiety rather than planting some roses and just being together with each other. And
Yeah, and I think we have to remember that, you know, it's not my job to save the world. It's not your job to save the world. My role is to do my calling, my gift, to respond to what the living world is asking of me. And that's where hope comes in. Because I find such a struggle with so many ways that we talk about hope that feels a little like a trip to Disney.
Yep.
But what I'm choosing to believe, and I too truly believe, that if I do my part and you do yours and others pick up their pieces that they're called to do, and we entrust this amazing, beautiful, wise, long-lived Earth to continue to do what she has always done so well to enable flourishing, then that's where we move toward a future of great liveliness.
Mm. yeah, there you, here you have it too. You know, that, that Sophia's basic initiative is toward flourishing, that life really wants to take care of itself and continue, and it will, and we can just decide that we want to be part of that. we don't want to be the forgotten chapter, but no, yeah, we want to be in that dance.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. Thank you, Leah, for your reflections. Friends, this is a nice, gentle read. It's so accessible and enjoyable. Here you get to hear personal stories and broader conceptual thinking, and nothing overly academic or, you know, weird, but just really, you know, here it is. It's the human thing. So thank you for your work, Leah. And thanks to all of you. If you have questions, reflections, stories to share about anything we touched on, please send them in through dangerouswisdom.org. If you have some pre-questions about trees, maybe if we can get Leah and Beth here.
There we go.
Maybe we can address some of those as well. So send all that through. And in the meantime, this is Dr. Nikos, your friendly neighborhood soul doctor, reminding you that your soul and the soul of the world are not two things. So take good care of them.